as black people in America, it's like you're walking into a church and you smell like weed. Everybody's looking at you. And you wasn't even smoking the weed. You just kind of like walked past somebody's car and you just brought the odor in with you. Being black in America is like an assumption of guilt.
When it's really the other way around.
Yeah.
In reality.
In reality.
Welcome to What's Underneath, the podcast that will inspire you to accept the skin you're in and step into your most whole, powerful self.
I'm Lily Mandelbaum, and sitting next to me is my mom, Elisa Goodkind, and we are the creators of Style Like You.
In our podcast, we bring you the extended interviews from our video series, The What's Underneath Project, in which diverse role models strip down to open up and claim the power of the skin they're in.
The first step to self-acceptance is being radically honest about the things you're ashamed of. And by listening to these stories, you are tapping into the healing power of vulnerability, truth sharing, and the unshakable bravery to be yourself.
You're giving yourself permission to recognize that you are completely beautiful and enough as you are.
Hey, everyone.
Hey, everyone. How are you doing? We hope you're all doing well.
We're really excited to be introducing today's What's Underneath storyteller, Leon Ford. We interviewed Leon in New York in early December. We did our LA interviews first, and then we flew to New York and quarantined for a while before we shot our New York episodes, and Leon was one of them. And when we got to the shoot, I just remember feeling like this wave of peace come over me being in Leon's presence. He had just driven 7 hours. He had woken up at 3 a.m. to drive 7 hours with his cousin to New York. We had no idea he was doing that long drive for us. We didn't really get how far Pittsburgh was from New York when we were arranging the interview. And he was in such a peaceful state of mind, was just so present. And it was just, yeah, immediately medicine for both of our souls. And then let alone how the interview went and hearing Leon's story. I don't know if I've ever felt kind of so high and calm and present and inspired really in my life. I mean, I don't say that lightly, because I think every What's Underneath interview is completely transformative and cathartic, but there was something about Leon's that I did feel like I was in the presence of someone who was truly enlightened, or definitely on their way to being enlightened. Mom, what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I think, and as far as being enlightened, there's no ultimate enlightenment. I think that we're all on different levels and journeys towards awareness, which I think is, you know, the same as enlightenment. Leon, I think, feels so deeply enlightened, and it's so powerful to be in the same room with him, because his story is one of the most empowering stories that I, in all of the interviews that we've done, what's up there in one of the most transformative and empowering, because he has been able to take one of the most horrific incidents imaginable that a society could,
as a result of a society's
ills could do to a human being, and turn it into love. All he talks about is love, and how he just wants to be love,
and to spread love
and to live his life out so that he can affect love in the world and make an impact with love in the world, being about as open as, you know, anyone's could be.
One thing that I'm thinking of is just how he said right away in the beginning of his interview that he's feeling good because he is not on social media right now, and that he's feeling really connected to his purpose, and that's why he's feeling so good. And that without social media, it helps him to stay really connected to his purpose. And I think that's something that is such an important thing for us all to glean from him. I know for myself, social media can often be such a like thief of my presence and a thief of my joy and my trust in my own path, because it can be such a source of comparativitis and thinking that someone else has it better than you, or thinking you need to be more like someone else or get as many more likes, more followers, more. You know, you could really feel that with him, that he's not letting his light and his path be obstructed by this external bullshit. As a result, you feel how powerful he is and how content he is in himself, or his power is in that kind of like contentment with himself.
One of the things I've been thinking about lately in terms of what you just said, the measuring and comparing that you do with other people on social media, it makes you feel as though you're not this. So you don't accept where you are, and then you can't receive your inner truth and the messages that you need to receive from your most deep and inner self that is ultimately your power. Your power is not in the gripping to external measurements, but your power is in your source and in the part of you that is connected to your deepest truth. And it stops that. It's a wall to that. So that's something that Leon, you can really feel that in his presence. And I think part of that is also coming from his dedication to meditation, which is something that he talks about in terms of how much it has transformed his life and his view of what happened to him and the purpose of his life. He sees a purpose to everything that has happened to him by being so deeply connected to his inner truth through the stillness and the quiet of being with himself without external noise.
Yeah, and I think his story is also just like speaks to the power of self-acceptance and how much is possible in your life when you do accept your life circumstances, and not to say that you accept the oppression or the societal ills that have created unfair life circumstances such as police brutality and systemic racism. Leon speaks to how like acceptance or self-acceptance, it's not like, oh, I'm perfect and I love myself all the time and I feel good about my life all the time and I feel fine. Acceptance is also your ugly emotions and accepting the things that you're struggling to accept. It's like this radical acceptance. And he talks about how his healing came so much when he has to accept the moments where he still has a bit of fuck the police in him, and where he's angry and where he feels sad and hurt. So acceptance is not like this flowery thing, this fake facade of self-love, I feel good all the time. It's like the acceptance of the dark as much as you accept the light, and it's this releasing into what is and not resisting what is. You can transform it into your path, and you can help make change in the world and help affect society such that that same ill doesn't get repeated again. And I think Leon's an incredible, honestly, mind-blowing,
and that's really the definition,
the ultimate example of that.
What you just said is actually the definition of transformation. You're transforming something that was a negative and dark act by accepting it. You can see it as a message, as a delivery to yourself of your purpose and your ability to then stop the continuation of that dark act. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's ultimately what transformation is.
So without further ado, we really can't wait for you to hear Leon's story.
He's a hero.
He's definitely one of our heroes. Can't wait to hear your thoughts and hope that your heart feels opened and that you feel more accepting of yourself by listening to Leon's story.
And please, we would love to hear directly from you your thoughts on Leon's episode, anything that you would like, possibly that we discuss more. I think that if you DM us on Instagram, that might be the best way for us to connect with you personally. So we look forward to hearing from you then and there. And love to you all.
Bye.
So can you just talk about how you feel right now?
I feel good. I feel a strong sense of purpose. I feel connected. Part of that comes from the fact that I haven't been on social media. And the other is because I've been doing the self-work that has prepared me to face people who were once triggers, and they're no longer triggers for me. And so I'm able to work with people who have caused me pain in the past. I'm able to think objectively and solve problems. A lot of times as activists, we can be so emotional and passionate about our beliefs, and sometimes that causes even more division. And so therapy, along with my practice of meditation and mindfulness, has, you know, helped me to cultivate a space of love and compassion where I'm able to focus on the North Star And the North Star is really, for me, to build community, a sense of community where everyone has access to live a prosperous lifestyle.
Did you just get off of social media recently?
Yes, I've been struggling with it for maybe a few months. Found myself so overwhelmed. Every time I would go on social media, the rhetoric, the hatred, they didn't make me feel good spiritually. And so I took a step back. And I just started working with people. It's amazing what happens when people connect with people and those connections are facilitated by other people that those people love, respect, or trust, maybe all three. And so I've met with Democrats, I've met with Republicans, I've met with Catholics, I've met with Jewish people, I've met with Muslims, I've met with Quakers, you know, and I see them for who they are. And we may not agree on everything, they may not agree on everything, but we all make up community. We live in a time where if someone's truth may be different, you know, we dismiss their truth. And I don't think that's right. And so through therapy, I was able to learn more about myself and ask, how can someone's truth be harmful? You know, why is it harmful to me? And so I worked through those triggers within myself. And then I'm able to sit, now I'm able to sit and converse with those people and help them understand my truth in a very healthy way. And sometimes I'm able to influence them, share my perspective, and help them learn something. Sometimes they teach me something, right? Where it's not right or wrong. It's just, you know, some things just are. One of my favorite things right now that I'm working on is I've been talking to activists, fellow activists, for years. And activists usually talk to activists. Educators usually talk to educators. Politicians usually talk to politicians. Police officers usually talk to police officers. And so you'll have the activists coming up with solutions, and they may say, defund the police, which pisses police officers off, right? It makes them not want to engage in a conversation, so they're closed off. But once we realize and understand that as human beings, you know, there's just certain universal laws, we can kind of simplify these problems and see each other as human beings and figure out how do we make this world better for everybody.
So I could just talk about everything you said right now forever, and we're definitely going to get back to it in a little bit. But can you just talk about what your style says about you?
My style says that I'm simple and I'm laid back.
Are you simple and laid back as a person?
Yes.
Always?
Always, yeah. I feel like when I was younger and before I got shot, I was louder. Yeah, my personality was much more loud. Yeah, now I'm just kind of like, I like to take the back seat and just cruise. After I got shot, I had to redefine what manhood was. And so I was shot when I was 19 years old. And my manhood was really based on like external power, right? My ability to like make more money than somebody, my ability to like beat somebody up. I used to box too. My ability to like date more women. That's what I thought a band was. And then I got shot and those things didn't matter anymore. So I had to rebuild my idea of what it meant to be a man. And one of those attributes was, you know, just being vulnerable. Because, you know, now I'm in a wheelchair, you know, I felt exposed. And In the beginning, it was one of my, what I perceived to be a huge weakness. And so I made it my strength. And that was the beginning of me not only redefining my manhood, but redefining who I was going to be to my community. I learned that I didn't have to be loud to be powerful. I didn't have to be physically strong in a way where I had to dominate somebody to be powerful or to be a man. I could just be myself. I could lead with love and be equally and even more respected in the spaces that I will occupy. And I believe that, you know, I have more love, respect, and admiration, you know, for my community than I did when I was 19 years old and I thought I had to be all of these different things. And I like to show young people that, especially young black men, that, you know, they don't have to be, you know, these super dominant individuals to gain their respect. They can just be themselves. Just being a stand-up human being, right? Speaking truth, having integrity.
Can you talk a little bit about the assumptions that people make about you based on how you look?
Yeah, I think people assume that I need help. Sometimes they assume that I don't need help.
Can you give some examples?
Yeah. So, I don't know, like, for instance, when I came in this room, there may or may not have been an assumption that my cousin drove me here. But he slept the whole ride. and I actually drove the entire way from Pittsburgh here to New York. So that's like one assumption.
Is that you can't drive?
Yeah, that I can't drive, yeah. And I live alone. So I'm fully independent. But then, I don't know, let's see. I think sometimes people assume that they shouldn't ask me if I need help. Like if I'm grocery shopping or something.
And you can't reach for something?
Yeah, and I can't reach, and I'll see people, or I'll, like, be, like, you know, pushing a cart, like, to my car, and people will just be, like, so hesitant on if they should ask or not. But I don't know, I don't, you know, if people ask, like, I don't take it personal. It doesn't, like, make me upset. And I will let people help me. I lived in Europe last year, and I found that Europeans were much more likely to help than Americans. Like, especially when I was in Croatia, I would go weeks without seeing another black person. But they didn't see me as a black person. They seen me in a wheelchair, and they're like, yo, we need to help you, whatever you need. And I use it as a lesson, a teaching moment for some of my friends who are in wheelchairs because, you know, not always gonna have somebody there to help you. So you have to be a problem solver. You know, you have to figure out, since no one's obligated to help me, what do I do? You know? And that's how I've become self-sufficient.
So you were saying that in Croatia, it was notable to you that they didn't see you as a black man in a wheelchair, or just a black man, period, and that they saw you just as a person who needed help. Can you talk a little bit about that, maybe as contrasted to what your experience is in America with that?
Yeah, it was interesting because when I got to Croatia, and even it was similar in Valencia, Spain, I expected people to just stare at me, right? Because it was like, I'm the only black person here. And they didn't. And I was just like, yeah, y'all don't see me. I'm way different than y'all. And, you know, even in my hometown, like if I go to a predominantly white neighborhood in Pittsburgh, I feel like, you know, I can feel all the stereotypes just weighing me down, right?
Yeah, like what?
Yeah, maybe that I'm a threat, right? Or even, I used to be self-conscious to tell people I was shocked because I kind of felt like there was this assumption that I was shocked. Whereas a white counterpart, there may be an assumption that they were in a car accident or a dirt bike accident, you know? And then, oh, don't let me tell somebody I was shot by a police officer. It immediately goes to, what did you do? You know? There's just a bunch of stereotypes associated with race here in America that I didn't experience in Europe, right? In Europe, there was an assumption that I was in a car accident, right? And when I would tell people that I was shot, they couldn't believe it at all. I had people ask me, like by a doctor, like a shot with like a real gun, you know? And then when I would say I was shot by a police officer, they just couldn't even comprehend that experience. And I found that to be very interesting. Europe was a very interesting place. Even in, like, when I would tell stories, here in America, right? If I tell someone I was shot, they ask, was it a white officer or a black officer, right? In Europe, there's not that concept of, like, race, right? Black and white. The moment I tell a story and I say, this black guy or this white guy or this black woman, white woman, they immediately say, oh, you're American.
Wow.
Immediately. So I found that to be very interesting. It changed my perspective and how I write. Because I remember being in Croatia, and I was at the city square, and I seen this black dude. And like when I seen him, I was just like, yo, bro, what's up? And he just couldn't identify with me, right? Then I realized the black American experience was much different than what black people from other places around the world may have experienced.
And shows you how deep brainwashing, programming, and conditioning is.
Yeah, it's very deep. And whenever I enter a predominantly white space, I could feel me adapting, right? Like kind of like a chameleon to kind of disarm them.
What kind of things do you do?
Smile, right? It's like smile, talk about things that they would be interested in.
Like what?
Sometimes sports, sometimes music, you know, your whistle. Yeah, I mean, there's so many different things that you can do. Lighten your voice a little. Huh. I used to do it more. Now I'm just me.
Before being shot?
No. Before, you know, I became confident in myself entering these white spaces, right? Because it was always like I wanted to show them that I was intelligent and worthy. So I would use certain words. I would have, you know, a different tone in my voice. But now it's like, yo, I'm me. And I'm going to show up as me. And I know I'm worthy, you know? Before, I just felt like I had so much to prove. Most black people don't even understand, right? It takes a certain level of privilege for, you know, a black person to understand true history, right? And to articulate how they've been affected by white supremacy, right? The ones that, you know, they have, you know, generations of families who graduated from HBCUs, or they have, you know, parents or grandparents who were in the movement. That's a privilege, you know. For me, I didn't have that privilege. I was shot when I was 19. I didn't even know who my mayor was. I was raised on just you gotta hustle, you gotta make money, right? I didn't really have a understanding of black history or identity. My identity was the hustle. Now, like after I got shot, I sought out to understand, you know, history. How did this happen to me? So it came later, but I was raised, you know, just to know numbers and to get it out the mud, right? To be ambitious, to be innovative, and to, you know, not to take no for an answer. You gotta figure it out. And so that resilience, right, helped me with my fight. I'm from the hood, but I was never living in poverty, never poor. I was a very privileged hood kid. I had whatever I wanted. We lived a very good life. I definitely credit my parents for creating those opportunities for me to feel free, even though, you know, there was you know, a sense of oppression. But I never felt oppressed until I got shot.
So can you paint the picture a little bit about what was going on in your life when you were 19, and then what happened?
I was the average 19-year-old, right? I was a year out of high school. I had applied to go to like this community college. I had started some classes out of like a trade school to get my CDLs. I was boxing. I was also rapping. I was a musician. I was also a videographer, filming music videos for some of my friends. And just like having fun, right? Going to a bunch of like college parties and like just turning up.
Were you the life of the party?
Yeah, I was popular. Which is funny because like I was kind of born popular, right? Because like my parents were popular, my older siblings were popular, and then like there goes me. It was a Sunday that I got shot, and I was going to visit my cousin who had owed me some money. And yeah, when I left from there, I was driving down the street. It was a one way, and the police officers were coming up the wrong way.
They were coming the wrong way when you were going up the right way?
I was going the right way, yeah. I was going the right way, and they were coming up the wrong way. They didn't have their sirens on or anything. And I told you I was like real confident, and like, so I'm like, yo, what are y'all doing? And I'm looking directly into their car, which is like, bro, when you're black, you're just not supposed to do that, like in the neighborhood, especially at night.
It was two of them?
Yeah, there was two officers.
White or black?
White officers. So there's two white officers in the car. And I just like, I looked directly into their car, and I was like, kind of like giving them the look like, man, yeah, what are y'all doing, you know?
So you're like both in your cars looking at each other. Wait, you're facing each other, right?
Yeah, exactly. And again, you just don't do that. Like when you make eye contact with police officers in the neighborhood and you're young and you're black and you got a decent car, you just know like, oh, they're about to pull me over. And so when I made eye contact with them, I knew that in that moment that they were gonna pull me over. And so what I did was I drove to the stop sign, and then when I made a left, and as soon as I made the left and I knew they couldn't see me, I just sped all the way up to the next stop sign, which is why I knew they had to drive really, really fast to catch up to me. So I was at the next stop sign, but I made a right onto a street called Meadows, and I was going across the bridge. By the time I get across the bridge, I knew that they weren't going to catch up to me unless they were really trying to get to me. Which now, like after going to trial, we found out that they were going almost 100 miles an hour, right, to like kind of catch up to me, even though I didn't like break any laws. And so I'm driving over this bridge. They get behind me. They're about like 30 feet behind me. And so I'm like, all right, they're going to pull me over. And so I come to another stop sign, made a left. When I made the left, now they're right behind me. And I'm like looking in my rearview mirror. Lights come on. So there's like a cultural thing right now, right? So it's like, for me, I knew that they were gonna pull me over.
I get that.
And I knew that I didn't do anything wrong. I knew that I didn't have any drugs or weapons on me. So I wasn't nervous. I already had my driver's license, registration, and car insurance ready. And so the officer comes to the window. I kind of cracked it and like gave him my information. And he snatched it off of me. So I kind of knew like, man, this is about to be weird, you know? I wasn't really scared, but I kind of knew like, here we go, right? And so they he went to the car, ran my information. I knew I didn't have any warrants or anything. So, yeah, I was just, relaxed, just waiting. Right, I'm either gonna get a ticket or not. And so they come to the car, they're asking me like where I live, and I'm like, bro, like, y'all got my license, like whatever. Then they start asking me about this guy named Lamont Ford. So they're like, yo, you know Lamont Ford? I'm like, bro, I don't know Lamont Ford, you know? So after a while, they start insisting that I was Lamont Ford. They're like, you got a fake ID, like, you're Lamont Ford, you know? I'm like, bro, I'm Leon Ford. You know, I gave him my birthday's 3/16/93. This is my address, so on and so forth. I knew they wanted to get in my car, right? But they didn't really have a reason to. So they're trying to figure out how they can like finesse their way to search my car. And so now they're threatening me, right? If you're lying, you know, we're gonna, you know, kick your ass and all this stuff. So now I'm like, man, this is really getting weird. So one of the officers reached inside my window and unlocked the door. So I'm in my head, like, I'm pulling off. And so they open up the door and they're standing in the doorway. They try to grab me. And I hurry up and put the car in drive and try to drive off. And what I didn't realize is they called backup. There was an officer on the passenger side. So as soon as I pulled off, the officer that was on the passenger side jumped inside my vehicle and he just immediately starts firing.
He's in the passenger seat?
Yeah, he's in the passenger seat. The gun is on my chest, right? Like I can feel the steel. And I'm holding the steering wheel and I can just, feel it, right? So I thought it was so close. I thought he was tasing me. Immediately after I crashed, get yanked out the car, they slammed me on the ground.
They'd already shot you?
Yeah, I was already shot. So as soon as he jumped in the car, he's firing.
How many times?
5 times. And point blank range. And so I'm laying face down on the ground. So at this point, I still was thinking that I got tased. But then I started, having the blood coming out of my mouth and I could feel all the blood under me on the sidewalk. And I was just like, yo, y'all really shot me, And so they're going through the trunk of the car, they're tearing up the car. Where's the drugs? Where's the guns? I'm like, bro, I don't have no drugs or no guns. I'm like, y'all really shot me, One of the officers ended up, he even like knelt like right next to my head and he was like, yo, I hope you fucking die. And I was just telling myself like, bro, I cannot die. Like, I do not want to die right here like this. And I was just breathing, I was taking deep breaths, right? Like how I would do, at the gym. So I'm taking deep breaths, counting my breaths. And I just remember an ambulance coming. They cut my clothes off of me and rolled me over, put me up on the gurney. I remember being inside of the ambulance and it was just so white. I didn't want to stop talking. I gave them my grandma's name, my dad's name, my mom's name, grandma's phone number, my dad's phone number, mom's phone number. I gave them all my grandparents and my parents' birthdays. I just tried to keep talking until I just kind of went out, and then I woke up in the hospital. I was on a 24-hour guard. My family, they weren't able to see me for like 2 weeks because I was under arrest. I remember a doctor coming in my room, and he was like, yeah, we got good news and we got bad news. Good news is you're going to survive. Bad news is you're not going to be able to walk again. It really didn't bother me in that moment. I feel like the depression came for me maybe like once I got home, right? Because like when you're in the hospital and you're healing or you're in therapy and like you're trying to, as I'm trying to learn how to adapt to life in a wheelchair, it's kind of easy in the hospital. But once I got out the hospital and I went home and like they had to move my room to the living room because couldn't go upstairs. I never saw my bedroom again after that.
What happened to the police officer?
The police officer. He's actually a detective now. Yeah, so.
Nothing happened?
No, nothing happened. Yeah. I was charged. I got charged after being shot. And that's what really like kind of sparked my activism, because I was charged, you know, I was facing, you know, I had several felony offenses. They said I was facing up to 20 years in prison.
For what?
Multiple counts of reckless endangerment, multiple counts of aggravated assault, escape, resisting arrest. The trial lasted about 3 weeks long. I was found not guilty. It's very complicated, right? And I think that, you know, when we see police shootings, right, we think, oh, police community and, you know, and then you have the mayor's office, and then, but you also have the DA's office, and if the DA's office is not going to pursue charges, then, I mean, it's very complicated, right? And this is why we can't afford to opt out of the political process. The system works for who it's supposed to work for, because people are literally buying their interest.
Right.
And yeah, and so we have to buy our interest. We have to use, you know, our capital, our money, and we also have to use our social capital, right? Our platforms and also our votes to buy community interest, right? And until we do that collectively, then, you know, these systems are going to deny groups of people justice.
Can you talk a little bit about the emotions that you remember feeling? Like, I don't know, the stages of them from when you first became conscious again and then when you got home and all of that.
I felt a bunch of anger. Yeah.
When did that kick in? Right away?
Yeah, I hated all white people. Yeah, and it's like, I had a teacher, her name is Ms. Shank, and she helped me out a lot with that, because she was my sixth grade teacher, and she just always kept up with me, and she just gave me so much love. And so when she came to visit me, I was just like, well, I hate all white people but her. And, you know, she just kind of helped me, you know, with that anger. And I was like, no, I hate all white people. I hate all police officers. But then I had like some relatives who were police officers. So I was like, yeah, I don't hate them. I hate all the white cops. It's interesting, like it took years and years. But I don't know when the shift happened for me. Like when I became more open to like working with police officers. Maybe it was one of my professors. I have a really good mentor friend and a professor, him and his wife, Dr. Kalanti and his wife. They're, you know, a white family, and they are really genuine people. They care about the work, and Dr. Kalanti like trains police officers. And he always like invited me into these spaces to talk to police officers and to share my story with new recruits. And I think that was like the first time that I really had the opportunity to kind of build with police officers. And I just kind of seen how I could have an impact. And so although I still had these feelings in my heart, I was willing to enter those spaces to kind of change the way policing what happened in Pittsburgh. And I started to build relationships with police officers.
How did the police officers respond to your story?
There were some that didn't want to talk to me, and there was others who were very supportive. And so in the beginning, I just would connect with the ones who were supportive of my story, who would say, what happened to you was wrong. It was poor police work, you know. So there were those types of police officers. It was hard because I would get triggered all the time, right? Because there's just, again, the language, right? Police officer would say, well, you know, your shooting, you know, it wasn't justified, but this other shooting over here was definitely justified. And it would trigger me. It would make me not want to talk to them.
What would it feel like when you got triggered?
Anger and hatred all over again.
What does it feel like in your body when you get triggered? What's the response?
The response is, I'm in my mind thinking about doing something to them. Right? It's like, I don't even remember like what the actual feeling was, but the thoughts were like, I would have that revenge in my mind. Mm-hmm. You know, I would want to see those police officers hurt. I didn't have a lot of support from traditional leaders. And so I had to kind of build and create my own movement in Pittsburgh. We live in a society that only respects death. Right? So, you know, you have to die to get your flowers. Even with like a lot of religions, right? Religions put an emphasis on after death. What's gonna happen after death? How you gonna make it to heaven, right? And it's like, well, why can't we create that here now? Like I felt, you know, because I didn't die, I didn't have that strong support and outrage that a lot of the other cases had. When I went to civil trial, like the courtroom was empty, right? And this was like during the same time when Colin Kaepernick was protesting, right? And I went viral, like there was this video of me and my son walking. I could walk with like these braces. And a video of me and my son, I went viral. My son was saying, keep pushing, Dad, don't give up, you know? And like a lot of these people retweeted it and they retweeted that video, but nobody supported my case. I was going to trial the same week, right? And so that was kind of hurtful. And it made me question, you know, a lot of the activists, you know, who have these huge platforms, their authenticity, you know, why, like, what are you doing it for? And it's unfortunate because you have people who, you know, don't have real solutions exploiting the stories of these grieving families. So I'm very much against putting families up on the news after their loved ones are murdered because they're grieving, right? And I understand that, you know, the attorneys want this outrage and they feel as though having a family speak out is gonna have this, a different type of impact on people. But I feel like the families should be protected and the families should be surrounded by love and authentic people who want to help them heal versus people who want to exploit their pain for self-gain, right? To raise money for political agendas. These are people who are, you know, dealing with a lot of trauma. Like even for me, you know, because I've, you know, organized and I've built a platform for myself. But so many people were focused on my hero. Nobody was focused on my healing. And so while I was on the outside presenting to be, you know, this resilient person, I was dying on the inside. And it's until I decided to go to therapy that my life changed. Man, a march that's not gonna do anything. You feel me? That's not gonna bring their loved ones back. A settlement, they print money. They don't print lives. They don't print legs, you know? Doesn't mean anything, you know? And so I think it's very important, you know, for us, you know, as, you know, a community of people who care or who say we care, to be intentional about like, what does healing look like for these families? What does healing look like for a community that continues to lose people to gun violence, right? What does healing look like for a country? And until we start talking about healing on a you know, spiritual level, on a mental level, from a psychological level, then we're going to continue to suffer and we're going to continue to be triggered and we're going to continue to dismiss people's feelings, and we're going to continue to exploit people. And so that's why, like, I'm focused on, you know, healing. And I talk about therapy so much. I talk about mindfulness and meditation because I see how it has transformed my life and the people around me. And so I just think these are tools that we should utilize to change some of the things that, to heal, right? Because we can't change a lot of things, but healing is, it's a choice. It's hard, you know, it's easier to sit in your pain and be depressed.
I want to get into the journey of therapy and all the things that have transformed you. But before we do that, can you maybe paint a little bit more of a picture of what depression looked like for you? Like, maybe what were the different phases of your grief?
Depression, I mean, there's so many layers to depression, mm-hmm. right? It's interesting. I feel like from the moment I got shot, November 11th, 2012, to, you know, when I started therapy last year, it feels like one day, right? Like that whole time, it's kind of like a blur where I wasn't fully present. And I felt like I was in kind of like a emotional coma where I didn't allow myself to feel certain emotions. And whenever I did feel those emotions, it's because they were very intense.
Like, 'cause you were triggered.
Exactly. And I would be triggered by a lot of different things. Sometimes just seeing a police officer. I would be triggered when I would hear other cases of police brutality. I would be triggered whenever I just, you know, look at my wheelchair and be like, yeah, I wasn't born like this. You know, somebody put me here, you know. Somebody took my ability to walk. That anger, that frustration. Different coping mechanisms, just kind of running and trying to stay busy, 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 busy.
What were your coping mechanisms? Being busy?
Yeah, being busy, right? So from the outside looking in, people would applaud me because, like, yo, he's a hard worker, he's ambitious, you know, he's doing this, he's doing that. Oh my God, Leon is amazing. But that was really how I decided to cope. As soon as I got to rehab, and I was able to learn how to move around in my wheelchair, I was already, you know, thinking about my next steps, right? And that's connected to how I learned to view the world, right? I was raised to be a hustler. I never was sitting still. I learned how to drive before I knew how to get in and out of the bed by myself, right? My dad had to carry me, like lift me up, put me in my chair, lift me up and put me in the car. And you know, I would be in the car all day until I could call my dad, and he would leave from wherever he was at to come help me out, right? I had to catch up, you know what I'm saying? And I had to be ambitious. I had to be self-motivated. You know, I didn't wait for nobody to get me out the bed, you know what I mean? I had to learn, you know? I had to figure it out. And that resilience, right? It's so important, and it's a part of my core. It's a part of who I am. And a part of, you know, finding that was the support that I had. Like, I have hell of a parents. Like,
I can tell.
Yeah, I have some really great parents. And, you know, that love created in me this tenacity, right, to just, like, to push through, this resilience, right? This, I'm very audacious. Like, I just, you know, I'm like, yo, the world, like, I can get whatever I want from the world, and I'm worthy, right? I don't have to ask for permission to be great. I don't have to ask for permission to be, you know, appreciated or worthy. I have, like, this strong sense of self-worth, you know?
It's such an amazing thing what you're saying, because we can be so hung up by the blind spots that we have where we're looking at other people from afar or in social media and assuming that they have it better than we do, when in reality, there's so much that's going on inside a person and in their personal lives and all different layers and layers of things that can incapacitate and create them to be caged in ways that are not apparent. And so it's really impossible to judge someone's actual freedom, actual sense of love and self-worth. And it doesn't necessarily have to do with, a label, an ability to do a physical activity or not, or to have a certain job or not. None of these things are relevant to how someone feels free and happy and content and fulfilled in their lives.
Yeah, I meet people, right? And they would look at me in my adversity. They would look at me and like getting shot as like this huge adversity, like this huge hurdle. But then I look at them and I see their insecurities, their lack of self-worth, their issues with their parents. And I'm like, yo, I wouldn't be able, like, I can't understand it, right? Like, it's like, you know, for me, that adversity is tougher than getting shot, right? Because I was raised around so much love, right? Where getting shot was just like, all right, cool, how do I adapt? I always tell people, like, yo, if you want your children or children around you to be leaders, to be strong, to be resilient, to be, self-advocates and advocates for other people, just expose them to love, right? That love, it's so transformative. That energy is very important, and it's a solution that gets lost in all the complexities of the world.
So you were saying that at some point you hit like a wall with the busyness, and that you realized that it was kind of like blocking you from dealing and with your emotions and from healing, I guess.
Yeah. So I was exposed to meditation in the midst of me running for city council. So I settled my case, right? And right, that was supposed to be like, all right, settle your case, now you can live your life. Well, I settled my case and went into depression because I was like, yo, I've been fighting the city my whole adult life. What is next, right? I'm like, what am I supposed to do now? And so I decided to run for city council. And that was a fun experience. However, in the middle of my race, I got invited to a meditation retreat in Mexico. And I had this great friend named Dina Kaplan, who, invited me to, this meditation retreat that she was hosting. And we meditated every day for about 4 or 5 days, something like that. And it was during that retreat where I realized that, yo, I don't really want to run for city council. But how do I let all of these people who are supporting me know that this is not what I want to do, right? So I flew back from Mexico, back to Pittsburgh, and I went deeper into depression because, like, people had my yard signs, right, in their yards. They were wearing their Leon Ford t-shirts. I would, like, leave my apartment and cars would stop, like, yo, we got your back, right? So how do I tell these people that I'm not going to run for city council? And so I decided to see a therapist.
To help you with that or just in general?
Just everything. It was just like I was overwhelmed with life. And so I went to see the therapist. And the day after my session with my therapist, I dropped out of the race for city council. That was a Monday. That Tuesday, I broke the lease to my apartment and like flew to LA. And then from LA, I went to Montreal, Canada. Then I went to Philly. Then I went to Europe. Then I was in Europe for about 6.5 months between Croatia, Spain, I was in France, I was in Italy, I was in the UK, I was in Sweden. I was just all over Europe. But during that time, I was still practicing meditation and having therapy and really, you know, learned to embrace peace in my life. And I believe because of, you know, that experience between leaving America, going to therapy and practicing, you know, meditation, my life completely changed. You know, my perspective of my lived experience is different. My perspective of people is different. I have a stronger sense of identity, you know? And I just kind of embrace who I am and try to share my gifts with people around me. And I try to learn from people as they share their gifts with me.
When was the last time you cried?
I don't remember the last time I cried.
Because it doesn't happen often?
No, I don't cry often. It's something that I'm working on. Yeah, I wanted to cry around September 30th. That's the day that my baby sister was killed, but I didn't cry. Sometimes I feel guilty for not crying.
Why?
Because I feel like I should cry, and part of me wants to cry, but I haven't cried.
Why do you think you don't?
Big boys don't cry. It's like, it's so deeply embedded in me. And even though I'm aware of it, it's still hard to cry. I can remember like the first funeral that I went to. I had a cousin named Darnell. He was shot and killed. I had to be like 5 years old. I remember my grandma sitting on to the right of me and then my aunt Linda sitting to the left of me, and they were crying. And I was, they were passing the tissue around, and I would give tissue out. And I remember after the funeral, I ran up to my dad, and I was smiling, and I was like, "Dad, guess what?" He was like, "What's up, dog?" It's like, "Yeah, I didn't cry."
Meaning like you were proud that you didn't cry?
Yeah.
When did your son come into the picture in all of this?
So my son was born while I was in the hospital. So I was shot November 11th, 2012. And he was born January 1st, 2013. In the same hospital too. Yeah, my son is he's very mature for his age. Like last week, we were like binge watching Harry Potter. And I was like on the couch and I was dozing off when his mom was coming to pick him up. And he had left. When I got up off the couch, I went in my bedroom and he made my bed. And I was like texting like, "Yo, son, like, you know, thanks for making my bed. Like, you're the best son ever." And he texts me back like, "You know it," like with the muscle emoji. And I was like, this kid is like me. His truth is his truth and it's normal for him. And it's very important, you know, truth and truth is a choice. Sometimes we may be like, we may want to hold on to a lie because it's comfortable, right? But you know, truth is, it can be uncomfortable sometimes, but it's so valuable.
When do you feel the most vulnerable?
I feel the most vulnerable when I'm trying to suppress my vulnerability.
Such as?
If I'm trying to pose like I'm not hurt about something. For instance, I have a lot less of this now than I did in the past, but there have been like police shootings where I told myself that, you know, "Oh, it's okay. You know, I'm fine. I'm not bothered by it," you know? And this is before going to therapy. So I suppressed those feelings and they end up surfacing another way, mainly through like my protest, right? And just being so angry and frustrated with leadership. And so what is different now is that I acknowledge, you know, my anger. I acknowledge my sadness. I acknowledge my frustration in a way, in a healthy way, mostly when I go to therapy or through writing. Then I don't feel the need to throw it at people. And throwing it at people, I mean like what I used to do on Twitter or Facebook, right? I would just send so much hatred toward the people that I hated or caused me pain. But now I'm able to acknowledge those emotions and have conversations with people in leadership position to try to find innovative ways to move toward healing and to solve problems, right? And so through therapy and through mindfulness and meditation practices, right, I've embraced the equanimity, right, of life. And I'm able to say, I do care. I am hurt. I am sad. I am frustrated. I am angry. You know, once I acknowledge those emotions, I can kind of let them go, right? Kind of like, you know, this quote that says, feelings are visitors, right? They come and go. So I let go of my attachment, my emotional attachment to those emotions and kind of let them flow naturally, which it's liberating for me, right? Because I don't beat myself up. Right. I work with police officers. Right. But I still got a little bit of like fuck the police in me. Right. And so I could talk about healing and I could talk about working with police officers and all these things. But part of, you know, healing is acknowledging that I do have love in me, but I also have fuck the police in me. I have a little bit of a lot of things that, you know, I don't like. And we all do, right? But how do I acknowledge, you know, the good, the bad, without judging myself, right? So whenever I do see a police shooting or I am frustrated and I do like say to myself, man, fuck these people, you know, I don't beat myself up for it and say, yo, now I'm a bad person. Now I'm not authentic. Because being authentic is, you know, allowing yourself to go through all these different emotions.
And not hating any part of yourself because we're all of it.
Exactly, right? And then the thing is with that, right, then you're able to give that same love and compassion to people in society, right? So that's why I can hear a police officer say something I don't agree with. And I can be like, dang, I don't hate you for it.
So what about when it comes to like your journey with redefining your manhood and vulnerability and all that? How has that been with intimacy and dating? Has that been a journey?
My perspective of love has changed, mm-hmm. right? I thought love was to provide, protect, and possess, mm-hmm. right? But now I understand love. There's a quote that I really love from M. Scott Peck, The Road Less Traveled. He describes love as the will to nurture one's own and another's spiritual growth. And I really identify that with that definition of love, because everybody, you know, that I say I love, I'm making a conscious decision. I'm making a choice to nurture their spiritual growth. So that's the first layer of it. And then it's, I'm in an interesting place in my life where I've done a lot of reading about love and relationships. And culturally, like I grew up, like you're the man if you have like a bunch of women. And I used to like date a bunch of women. Well, not even date. Like I used to be like have relationships, right, with a bunch of women at the same time. But now, I see the value in just investing in one person and being committed to one person. Also, like, you know, a lot of people are talking about building generational wealth. What does that look like? And to me, generational wealth is more than just acquiring property and like leaving money to my son. But how do I show my son what a healthy relationship looks like so that he can, you know, build healthy relationships with someone and create an environment where his children and grandchildren can grow up in a safe and loving environment. And so I haven't found that person yet. I have a very old soul. I have an old soul and just being so committed to purpose, it just didn't align up for me yet. I just believe that my lived experience has showed me how mortal I am and how precious life is. And I understand that it's a very limited time that we all have, right? And so how do I want to spend the rest of my time? I'm not willing to bring someone else's trauma into my space if they haven't been intentional about doing the work, the self-work. And people say you shouldn't have a list. My list is someone who has a strong sense of self, a self-actualized human being who is connected to purpose, has the will to share her truth, her light, and her love. Not just me, but the world, right? Yeah.
That's amazing.
Who said you aren't supposed to have a list?
That's not a list. It's a sacred contract.
A sacred contract, yes.
Why in your journey, in your skin, in your body, why is it a good place to be?
To be me? I love me. I don't know. It's like I'm here for a reason, and I know it. You know, I believe that everything that I've experienced was purposeful. I wouldn't even say the good and the bad, because purpose is purpose, right? And so I believe that all of my life experiences have molded me to be exactly who I am, to be where I am, for a reason. And I'm not so much trying to find that reason. I'm just living it, right? I'm just being. I don't believe like a tree has to think about how to be a tree. It's just being. It's its nature to be. And so I'm just embracing my nature, and my nature is to love. My nature is to be present, and my nature is to give and share myself with the world around me. And I'm doing that. There's a healthy balance to it though, right? I'm not giving so much of myself to where I have nothing left. I'm giving just enough to be able to reproduce serenity in the world around me, right? So there's the self-love piece, there's the self-care, and then there's the self-correction, right? And with self-love, self-care, and self-correction, I'm able to share myself with people to just add value to the world. And that's why I'm grateful to be here in my skin. There's a reason why my name's Leon, right? There's a reason why I grew up in Pittsburgh. There's a reason why I was shot, right? Before I transition from this body, I hope that that reason is revealed to the world.
We hope you were inspired by this episode.
Until next week, that's it from me, Alisa.
And me, Lily.
If you were touched by this story, please take a moment to share the episode with any friends or family who could benefit from understanding that they are enough as they are.
And if you agree that facades separate us and being radically honest brings us together, please help spread the movement for radical self-acceptance by subscribing to, rating, and reviewing this podcast.
Each month, we'll send a free copy of our book, True Style is What's Underneath, The Self-Acceptance Revolution, to one of our podcast reviewers.
We can't skip ahead to a happy ending or live inside a Photoshopped image or an Instagram filter. There is no finding oneself when glossing over the truth.